As we all know, previously in tribal areas of Pakistan, lately in Syria, in Iraq, now in northern Afghanistan, there are many Central Asian militants among insurgent groups. Those who monitor the Central Asian militants talk about their unusual determination, skills and qualifications, which they say makes them one of the highly demanded group of militants for insurgent organizations abroad. So on the phone, I have Edward Lemon from University of Exeter in UK, who, among other things, has extensively worked on Tajik militants joining Islamic State. And then from Poland, I have Yusuf Lang, who is the author of Radical Militants in Central Asia. Then my colleague and editor of our IS tracking blog, Giovanna, is with us from somewhere, I believe, in the Middle East. She extensively writes about the Islamic State. You can read her on RFURL in the blog called Under the Black Flag. I have my colleague Bruce Panier with me in the studio. He is running RFURL Central Asia blog called Kishlak Owazi. So welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our show. Just to hook up the discussion, have a reality check on the ground. Here at the beginning of the program, I want to play two segments from Afghan parliamentarians whose own towns and districts are currently under the militants' control or threatened by them. First clip comes from the Bashir Ahmed Tayanch, who is the member of the Afghan parliament from Andhoy district of Faryab province in northern Afghanistan. The district also has a border with Turkmenistan. Here, what the Mr. Tayanch had to say about presence of militants in his region.
Hozircha Taliban o'sha askar nuqtai nazardan ya masalan niru nuqtai nazardan
Taliban itself sufficient in its human power. They are also able to execute their operations, but they are in need of engineering, logistic, technical and intelligence experts. So these skills are provided by those who came from outside, and most of them belong to Jundullah and Islamic movement of Uzbekistan. This is one of the reasons why foreign fighters are coming to Faryab.
So this was Mr. Tayanch, a parliamentarian from northern Afghanistan in the Afghan parliament. Another segment is coming from a former parliamentarian from the same province. His name is Serdar Rahmanoglu. He was also former diplomat in one of the Central Asian countries.
Urushni va turistik faoliyatlarni liderlik qilib, ularni yo'llovchilik qilib kelayotgan insonlardir. Ayni zamonda texnik.
Foreign fighters are the one who provide leadership to local Taliban. At the same time, they train Taliban on how to make bombs. They're skilled and trained people. They're not a simple individuals.
100ga yaqin bir nafar turistik harakatlarga ko'p nafar deb hisoblanishi mumkin.
So as you heard, Mr. Tayanch spoke about the specific skills that foreign militants, who he said mostly belongs to the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan and Jundullah, which is another militant group from Central Asia, are playing behind the Taliban's increasing determination in the north. And then, as you heard, the second speaker spoke about the leadership role that two Central Asian militants are playing among the insurgents in northern Afghanistan. Here I have to add a few more words on northern Afghanistan. It was always described as one of the relatively peaceful location in Afghanistan, and now here you go, it became one of the most dangerous spots in the country. So let's get rolling with Edward. Edward, you heard the Afghan parliamentarians talking about the skills of Central Asian militants. You had intensive research about the Tajik militants joining IS. So what type of background are they coming from, Edward?
Well, primarily having profiled the public profiles of over 50 Tajik militants who joined IS. The vast majority are obviously men. The oldest recruit amongst the fighters I surveyed was 41. The youngest was 19. So they're all primarily young Tajik men. The vast majority were recruited in Russia. So most of them were from poorer backgrounds, went to Russia in search of work, were radicalized in Russia, and then moved to Syria. So looking at some of the reporting done primarily by Radio Free Europe, interviewing the family members, interviewing members from their neighbors from their village. Most of these people, from what we can ascertain, most of these young men, before going to Russia, were not religious. They were not particularly pious. And that's obviously left their families in many ways confused as to why they've been going there. So I think we've got a specific situation where there's a mix of unemployment, of young men living in Russia, where they're in many ways outsiders within a society, face numerous, as we know, numerous legal problems in their everyday lives there. You know, if you visit mosques in Russia, which I have done, obviously it's a very kind of securitized space. There are riot police, there are metal detectors. You know, so it's easy in many ways for groups like IS to portray Islam as a religion as, you know, coming under attack.
Edward, coming to their professional background, you said they are mostly laborers working in the Russian market as a hard laborer. You heard the Afghan parliamentarians describing them as a skilled fighters who are actually providing training to the Afghan Taliban in its insurgency. Here, Yusuf, if you could jump into the discussion, you worked extensively on the radical Islamic militants in Central Asia. When you say radical, I mean, what type of people we are talking about? What type of professional they are coming from?
Well, they're coming from all sorts of professional backgrounds, but mostly we're talking about blue-collar workers. I mean, we're talking about construction workers, we're talking about electricians, we're talking about a whole lot of technical professions where their technical expertise is the key. I mean, person who can fix a car, person who can construct buildings, who knows how to do technical things, can easily be taught or even teach himself how to construct IED and other explosive devices, which is the technical knowledge that is needed by the Taliban. And also what is worth mentioning is that the IMU, Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, was founded by former people who were former Soviet soldiers, and a lot of militants which are joining right now the ranks of IMU do have some sort of military background. Usually it's a very short service in the military, but still it gives them advantage that others don't have. Even a short service in a regular military force will teach them certain skills which make them better fighters than those who have never had such a service and such experience.
Right. Giovanna, if you jump in here, I guess I read this news in one of your blogs that a Tajik militant being selected or elected as an emir of Raqqa in Syria. So where do Central Asian militants stand overall in Syria and Iraq among IS militants?
Well, actually, they're playing quite an important role, and that's borne out by something that happened today. ISIS released a video today of a group of Uzbek militants who've just pledged allegiance to the Islamic State. And the fact that ISIS went to the lengths of making a whole video of this pledge of allegiance, I think, just shows you how esteemed Uzbek militants are. We're seeing defections from Uzbek militants who've been fighting with Jabhat al-Nusra have now started to fight with ISIS. So there's a pull away from Jabhat al-Nusra towards ISIS. And they're considered to be quite prized fighters. There's a group of Uzbek militants right now fighting in Handarat in Aleppo, which is it's a very fierce battle against the Syrian government. And they're playing a very big role there in helping to push back the Syrian government, even though they're taking heavy losses, and they're coordinating with a lot of other groups there, including Free Syrian Army groups, actually. I think we're seeing that these militants are actually playing quite an important role within the insurgency and certainly within Islamic State.
I think Bruce will have something to add to that. In our previous discussions, Bruce, you are describing me, even the commanders of IMU being one of the former army soldiers in the Soviet army, like Jumana Mangani and others?
Yeah, and Yusuf touched on that. You know, Jumana Mangani was part of the Red Army occupation force in Afghanistan, and he became radicalized there. And he also, of course, had military training with the Tajik opposition, the Islamic wing of the Tajik opposition during the civil war. And I think a lot of reasons that he rose up so high in the Tajik opposition in the civil war days was because he had extensive training. I think he was a paratrooper, if I remember right, during the Afghan campaign. I'd also like to mention a couple other things about the Central Asians, and a lot of this will have to do with the Uzbeks, of course, but It's important to remember when you consider it, why are the Central Asians attractive to these different militant groups? Because generally speaking, the Central Asians have the highest education rate of any Muslim peoples in the world. It's a legacy of the Soviet Union, but we're looking at, 97-99% literacy. So even though many of them are blue-collar workers, unemployed, migrant laborers in Russia, and as a matter of fact, they are educated. And if you look at the Taliban, for instance, in the tribal areas and other places in Afghanistan, they're mostly illiterate. So the initial appeal of having Uzbeks from the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan come to Afghanistan and the tribal areas was, one, that they were educated and could read schematic charts, things like that, so they would know how to build bombs, as Yusuf mentioned, and as we've heard some of the other guests talk about, too, they do have some military training. So these were very valuable people to have, with some of these groups which didn't understand some of the technological details, how to build roadside bombs, things like that. And in the course of 15 years since the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan then first made its appearance, of course, they've gotten a lot of experience fighting. So it's not so surprising to see that groups in like the Islamic State would want them. I point out that there was an Uzbek commander, he was described as that, who was killed in Yemen not so long ago. Mm-hmm. And he was fighting on the side of Islamists. They only identified him as al-Uzbeki, which is just tells me that he's from Uzbekistan. But he was described as an Islamic militant who had come from Uzbekistan. So they've kind of built up this reputation of, and it's not just the Uzbeks now, it's the other people, of having a technological expertise, of having some basic military background that makes them very attractive to some of these other groups, just because they're able to, as we've heard the Afghan member of parliament say, two or three of them show up in a village and they can explain to a local group of militants how to build these devices, how tactics about how to attack the enemy, and they're used to attacking enemies that are better armed and better equipped than them, too. So they've become extremely valuable commodities in a lot of these militant groups.
I think I'm going to touch on what Edward mentioned at the beginning of the discussion, that those are mostly Central Asian migrant workers in Russian market who then ended up in Syria and all this stuff. So the thing is, other than skills, is there anything else that is specific to Central Asian militants that could play a role in fighting?
Well, I think obviously what we've seen, and my colleague Christian Bloyer wrote an interesting piece on this the other week, is obviously a move away from Afghanistan and Pakistan, which were the traditional arenas in which foreign fighters from Central Asia kind of applied their trade. And now there's been obviously a move towards Iraq and Syria. And he made a number of interesting points in his piece, including, the idea that the Islamic State is winning, is, achieving a great deal of success in its military campaign in Syria and Iraq. The fact that it's a new brand, the fact that they're using VKontakte, they're using Odnoklassniki, the main Russian language social networks, they're using videos and, the social media very effectively. And I think there's very specifically, for Central Asians who've been cut off from the ride of the Middle East for so many years under Soviet rule, there is something specific, there is something romantic, something attractive about fighting in al-Sham. It has a very specific appeal, I think, to Central Asians. That they can go and join their Muslim brothers in Syria fighting against Shiites, fighting against a secular regime. But I think there are some very specific dynamics to the Syrian conflict that makes it very attractive.
Right. Yusuf, how would you like to describe the aspiration or the determination of Central Asian militants to fight, like in the name of Islam? Is there anything makes them stand out compared to the other militant groups coming from other different backgrounds?
Well, compare, for example, to European, to radical Islamists from Europe, which are also fighting in Syria and have previously fought in Afghanistan and Pakistan. What makes the Central Asian radicals different is that except for Salafi ideology, which is the root cause for them to search for foreign jihad to fight in, they have no way back. They're often persecuted, even if they're not jihadists, they're not militants yet, they're often persecuted in their home countries for being more pious Muslims. In many Central Asian countries, for example, in Uzbekistan, being too pious of a Muslim, not necessarily a radical, can lead to troubles with the authorities, can lead to arrests, can lead to harassment and persecution. which radicalizes those people to eventually becoming terrorists, to eventually becoming armed radical militants. And they do realize that they have no return ticket. They can't return to their home countries. It's a going to have to fight in Syria or previously to Afghanistan and Pakistan is a one-way ticket. So contrary to the European militants, which can try to return, can serve a prison sentence and then be released into public, they know that for them, return is not an option. They have to fight there. They can either move to another place and fight, but they have to stay on that path, and there's no other option for them, which definitely strengthens their determination.
I think, Bruce, you were mentioning the technical skills of the Central Asian militants. You know, coming from the Central Asian background, my impression is this. I mean, with those skills, I think you can also find a job in Central Asia, right?
In theory, yes, but we know the system, you know, it's so corrupt out there. And again, you know, the point Yusuf just made about your degree of piety can limit your options. Generally speaking, unemployment is high throughout Central Asia, and it's not so easy to find work, or we wouldn't have all these millions of migrant laborers coming from Central Asia to, you know, to Russia, Kazakhstan, to a lesser degree. So it shows that, you know, it's frustration with having some education and not being able to find any of the kind of jobs that you're talking about that leads them to take, you know, menial labor jobs in Moscow. I'd just like to throw in one thing here, too, because me and you have talked about the Kyrgyz security chief a couple of weeks ago who said that the and this is being broadcast in Kyrgyzstan. The chief of the security committee said that they're paying $1,000 a day to militants that come from Central Asia. Now that's probably not true, but the head of our Uzbek service has said that they are indeed well paid. So if your option is making $30 or $40 shoveling snow in Moscow or going and getting paid this supposed $1,000 a day for fighting for the Islamic State. You know, there's an attraction there too. It's jihad and it's a job at the same time. So
are you saying that at least some of those militants coming from Central Asia are ready for hire warriors?
You know, I'm going to say that has, for some of them, that is part of the appeal. They could join a lot of different militant groups around the world. But I think part of the reason that the Islamic State has been able to attract so many people from Central Asia or the poorer countries is because it appears, you know, not only as we've heard that this group is winning and does have a plan, but also, you know, they've been very good at publicizing the fact that their fighters are getting homes, they're getting 3-4 wives, they're getting paid well, you know, and you could be a nobody from somewhere in Central Asia and all of a sudden you're, you know, supposedly the liberator of these towns in Syria and Iraq. So, I mean, it's kind of a full package for people who are looking at, you know, again, at shoveling snow or breaking ice off a roof somewhere in northern Russia. It's a lot better. It looks a lot better as an option.
Joanna, is that your feeling, what Bruce was talking about?
Yes, I think that was a very good point. I think that what I'm seeing is not just with Central Asians, but also with other militants from the former Soviet Union, for example, is that people are being given a sense of mission. If before they were a nobody in Moscow with some menial job, you know, they're now someone who's leading a brigade. They're taking part in a operation to liberate a town. They're even being suicide bombers. There was an Uzbek suicide bomber this week in Iraq, who was lauded at you know, his bravery at killing so many of the infidels. So it's giving people a purpose and a narrative that's very black and white, good versus evil. So, you know, it's a simple choice for a lot of people who, what would they rather do, have a menial job or suddenly be part of this grand narrative?
From last several weeks, we are talking about the Central Asian militants, of course, because we are focused to that region. I mean, is it irrelevant, Bruce, if I say, I mean, what number we are talking about here?
Less than 1,000, in my estimation. I mean, and even then, it's very hard to say how many of them are actually, you know, how many come straight from Central Asia to Iraq and Syria, as we've already heard and people have reported also. It seems like the majority of them have made their way to Russia somewhere at some time and become radicalized there. We have other groups of Uzbeks, for example, who have lived outside of Uzbekistan in fact, their families might never have lived in Uzbekistan for two or three generations as part of the Soviet Union. We have Uzbeks that have lived in the tribal areas of Pakistan and northern Afghanistan, and even some Uzbeks who have made it to places in Europe. So it's very difficult to say how many of this, and I'm going to say again, less than 1,000, actually came from Central Asia and went straight to Syria and Iraq. I have no doubt that there are certainly many hundreds, and that at one time most of them probably did live in Central Asia. But it seems like they became radicalized not in Central Asia, where the security is very tight around mosques, but rather in third countries, Turkey, besides Russia, I would name as being one of them.
Right. Edward, you had several reports, as you mentioned, on Tajik militants. You said you profiled 500 of them?
Yeah, I think I would echo Bruce's point. Fundamentally, people have been throwing these figures out there. You know, we've had numerous Russian analysts putting the number at 5,000 Central Asian militants, you know, whereas the governments have been slightly more reserved in their estimates. Fundamentally, no one really knows. My own analysis, you know, I can only find public profiles for something like 50 Tajiks, but the figure's been thrown out there at around 200. And I think, somewhere 100 to 200 is probably quite accurate. But obviously there's an interest behind the government's deploying quite large figures in order to justify, you know, authoritarian measures, as we've already been hearing, you know, this kind of assertive secularism in which the government closely regulates mosques, Islamic education, forces, men wearing beards and showing any sign of piety to shave. So yeah, I think there are interests in the governments in Central Asia themselves over exaggerating the threat.
Joanna, is that your feeling, looking at the situation from the field?
Yeah, I haven't seen evidence to indicate that there's thousands of people. I know that there's two main Uzbek Jamaats or factions within Syria. There's the Sabri Jamaat and there's the Imam Bukhari Jamaat, which has recently appears to have split, and some of it's gone to ISIS. And I think we're looking at, you know, a few hundred all told in those two groups. So yeah, I think that the figures of several thousand are definitely exaggerated.
Bruce, jump in if you
want. I just wanted to make a point, and Mohammed will remember this, but this is not my point. Noah Tucker from Registan was one of our guests a few months ago, and he's also done a lot of research on this, and he said that actually one of the reasons, and this might be a small one, but one of the reasons that you're getting more Central Asians going to Syria and Iraq these days as opposed to Afghanistan and Pakistan is that despite the proximity to Afghanistan and Pakistan, it's a lot harder to get there than it is to get into Syria and Iraq these days. And so it's much easier to go to Moscow or Turkey, you know, and then to Turkey and get into Iraq and Syria than it is to try to sneak across the Central Asian borders. And we know from previous reporting, too, that you run into a myriad of militant groups on the way who are all trying to recruit you into their group as you make your way toward your intended militant group. So you first be passed off to one group who says, why do you want to go all the way to the tribal area and join them when you can stick with us? But it's much more complicated to get into Pakistani tribal area and some of these places in Pakistan now than it is to just get to Iraq and Syria, strangely, even though it's further away.
You know, I was just wondering where, going forward, the Central Asian militants' role in the Syrian and Iraq conflict. Do you imagine a deputy of al-Baghdadi is becoming a Central Asian one day?
I think it's very likely. I think we're going to see more shift towards Islamic State from other groups. If only because Islamic State appears to be making great victories and the Syrian government forces are putting a lot of pressure on other groups in Syria, so it's easier to fight with Islamic State. I see a lot of respect given to Central Asians, particularly Uzbekis, in reporting in Islamic State social media accounts. So I think definitely... you know, and just also the fact that they seem to be, judging by their numbers, because there's actually not that many of them compared to Arabic foreign fighters, for example, but they do get a lot of attention. So they're obviously very highly prized in the same way that the Chechen fighters are. So, right. Yes, I definitely think that we could see more prominent figures from that community within Islamic State.
Bruce?
No, I agree. When there was those reports of the Tajik national, and we don't know that this is actually a Tajik. It could easily be an Uzbek, since they're 25% of the population of Tajikistan. But when this Tajik national was appointed to be the commander of Raqqa, a lot of people saw that as just a promotional move on the part of the Islamic State. And I think a lot of these videos that Uzbeks appear in and stuff are intended exactly for that purpose, that this is to show this, it's a recruitment film, essentially, that you can fit in over here. Will we probably see more Central Asians gaining prominent roles within the Islamic State? Yeah, I would imagine that it's in their interest to show that we accept people from, you know, good, pious Muslims from all kinds of different countries. And as long as it's more important that you're Muslim and where you're from isn't really important. But of course, the subtext is that, you know, we will take people from Central Asia and you can rise to this position within our group.
I'm just thinking a little bit differently here. I mean, the total number of Central Asian militants that are fighting in Iraq and Syria is somewhere between or around 1,000 people, right? Yusuf, are we exaggerating the influence and the role of the Central Asian militants in Iraq and Syria or other places?
Well, it depends. What do we mean by other places?
Afghanistan, Pakistan, yeah.
In Iraq and Syria, Central Asian militants are one of many groups of foreign fighters. We've seen much bigger influence of Chechen fighters than those of Central Asia. But in the context of other places, for example, Pakistan and Afghanistan, Central Asian and primarily Uzbek fighters have proven their worth. They're proven their skills to conduct terrorist attacks, for example, the recent attack on the Karachi airport. But also in the broader strategic content, in northern Afghanistan, they've proven their worth as a non-Pashto Taliban affiliate, which made possible recruitment of ethnic minorities in the northern Afghanistan by the predominantly Pashtun Taliban, which was previously not very popular among Uzbeks and Tajiks living in the northern Afghanistan. So they have proven their worth. They can be utilized by major terrorist organizations quite efficiently. And it's hard to tell how in Syria and Iraq how it will develop, but definitely I agree that they will continue to play an important role, also for propaganda purposes, to appointment of Uzbeks and Tajiks to prominent position definitely shows that here you're judged by your merits, not by your family record or by your money, but by your merits and by your skills, which is a great propaganda tool in the context of Central Asia.
Again, I'm sorry, going back to the discussion we had like three or four weeks ago, Bruce, you were in the studio at that time, that the general impression of the participants were Central Asian militants fighting in Syria or that among the Taliban, they are not really posing a serious threat to Central Asia. So if we think that they are playing more important role among the insurgent group globally, is there a reason for Central Asian authorities to relax?
I mean, I think the topic of our conversation a couple of weeks ago was, were they an immediate threat to Central Asia?
Yeah.
And I would say that they are not, you know, not in the next year or two probably. But these people are learning leadership skills too. And of course, that was Taher Yoldash, who was the leader of the IMU. That was his strong point, was that he was able to pick good quotes from the Quran at the proper moment and tell it to everyone. So he came across as this like religious figure who at the same time was a fighter. And these are kind of skills, leading people are the kind of skills that they're picking up right now. How do you get a group together? How do you organize it? How do you get them to go out and act as a unit and accomplish whatever their goal is supposed to be? So these are tactics that are being refined and honed in these different places. And that's going to be the major threat. We know there's discontent in Central Asia. We know a lot of people would rather get rid of the systems that they're living under right at the moment. What they don't know is how to accomplish that. And these people would offer one possible way of getting rid of the odious systems that exist in Central Asia right now. You know, again, if you look at the level of violence that's happening in Syria and Iraq, most Central Asians are going to reject that. Outright. And I've been in Central Asia during some of the most violent times in the last 20 years. And it never has reached the level that we see in Iraq and Syria today. And I don't think that will be particularly appealing. if you can divorce some of that from the actual idea of a movement that's meant to improve your personal life, then I think it would have a lot more appeal. And I'm sure that the Central Asians that are out there are going to figure, some of them anyway, will figure out a way to synthesize what they know about leadership and military tactics in Iraq and Syria and figure out a way to translate that into something in Central Asia. So a little bit more medium and long term, yes, there's a threat from these people.
I think we should conclude our discussion here. But again, I just want to give a microphone to Yusuf, to you. As someone who studied the Islamic radicalism in Central Asia, where do you see, in terms of radicalization, the situation in Central Asia is going to in the future?
Well, in the terms of radicalization of Central Asian Muslim communities, I think that two biggest factors which drive the radicalization is A, harassment and persecution from the state authorities of Muslim communities, which leads to radicalization, and B is poverty and employment, which also aids radicalization. And those are the two factors which strengthen the radicalization. For the last 15 years or so, we've seen that Muslim radicals from Central Asia, they don't conduct terrorist attacks in the Central Asia, but rather they go abroad where they can be an efficient and effective and deadly force, but they don't pose a threat for the Central Asia itself. Obviously, we've seen a growing number of, not radicals, but of fundamentalist Islamic communities in Central Asia, of Salafis, and they by themselves do not pose a threat nor for the security nor for the stability of the region and the state. Yet, as we've seen in Kazakhstan in 2011, when state authorities harass and persecute them, they can radicalize and they can try to perform terrorist attacks. I don't think that the situation is going to, that the Muslim radicalism and fundamentalism is going to be a game changer in the Central Asia. I mean, I think that the region has much more serious and grave problems than Muslim radicalism.
Joanna, is there anything you want to add? We are just reaching to the final part of the discussion.
Yeah, I think I'd like to add that one thing that's very different about ISIS is its propaganda networks, which are, I think, very appealing. So maybe these fighters themselves don't pose an immediate threat, but the ideology that they're espousing, they're using social networks. The major Uzbek group in Syria has a website and a video channel and a Twitter account, for example. And I think maybe people back home read these accounts and watch these videos, and there's a sense of coolness about it, a sense that this is an ideology that can help them advance in some way. So maybe that is a threat. At some level.
Okay, thank you, Joanna, Edward, Yusuf, and Bruce Panier here in Prague. It was a pleasure to talking to you, and we will catch up in the future. We continue to have this discussion biweekly at the moment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.